Hello, podcast fans. Adam Carolla here. I'm leading the fight against patent trolls who are threatening this medium. It's not about me. It's about the podcast you're listening to right now. If I go down, this show could be next. So visit fundanything.com/patent troll for more information on how you can keep podcasting alive. Thank you and mahalo.
Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray and Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast.
Fun episode.
Oh, man.
Another special episode on the road where we got to actually go into the home of the great Kevin Nealon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And a childhood dream.
Yeah.
Came to fruition.
There was a crazy moment that happened off mic where his six-year-old son is doing Fire Marshal Bill impressions for us.
Which is what I used to do.
Yeah.
And I started in comedy.
Yeah, and then when I was seven or eight, I'm doing Hans and Franz impressions for my parents.
Yeah.
And now Kevin Nealon's son's doing Fire Marshal Bill impressions.
Yeah.
It was just a really cool, mind-blowing
moment. He's destined for a great comedy career.
Absolutely. And a fascinating interview between the SNL stuff, early stand-up stuff.
Yes, a guy who didn't plan on really kind of being integrated in this business as much as he is, with just, you know, aspirations of just being a comic. And then, it also, you'll hear through these stories of how SNL came to be and Weeds and just, you know, all the movies and TV appearances. It's like, you know, obviously talent is a big part of this, but, you know, being in the right place at the right time and who you know. And it's not just, but, you know, the who you know aspect isn't like a guarantee, but it's like,
yeah.
I mean, hearing, his friendship with Dana Carvey, as you'll hear in the interview, is being a nice segue into the SNL experience.
A definite launching point, but then he's got the talent to back it up. But before we get to the interview, just our quick little notes. Thank you for continuously rating our podcast on iTunes. Thank you for all your tweets. We love getting them. We love reading them. And we retweet them a lot of times.
Yeah.
So,
big fan of the retweet.
Absolutely. And so please,
and continue to rate it on iTunes, obviously.
Yeah.
The more
that helps us. And also, if you want to help us, notice that you're not getting any ads during these podcasts. That means we're not making any money.
We're doing this for the love of the game. Damn it.
So if you want to make sure that we get some money, there's an easy step you can do, which doesn't cost you a thing. Simply, whenever you're going to go shop on Amazon.com, go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com.
For all the episodes, first of all.
Yeah, listen to all the episodes there, but then click on the Amazon banner. That takes you right to Amazon. You can shop normally, and then they kick down a little bit of that percentage to us, and we can somehow get some money from this labor of love that we put out to you guys.
But Brad, what if I want to buy some maroon pants and send them to Adam for Hanukkah next year?
Well, then you could still do that, and it will cost you not an extra dime, which is why it's great. It's a great way to support the podcast. And another great way to support us is to see us on the road. Adam, you going to be on the road?
Yeah, I'm going to be. Well, by the time this goes up, I will have returned from the St. Louis Funny Bone.
Wow, hey, those are great shows, weren't they?
Great weekend. Some of the greatest shows ever. I do love that club. This will be my second time there. Mm-hmm. I always, though, am a little weary when I do a... this will come out after that, and it's like, what if this is the weekend? I feel like I'm almost jinxing it, like something really traumatic happens.
Right, and this is your, like, after Adam and got I'm like stabbed at the club.
Sure, or the club burned down because of a guy kicked out who came back and burned it down, like, after I left, and then this comes out. I'm like, what a great time.
It was the best time. 127 people died.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully that's not the case. But I will be at the Las Vegas Laugh Factory at the Tropicana, headlining April 21st to the 27th.
There you go.
And then April 30th through May 4th at the Punchline in Sacramento. But before those, March 20th through the 23rd in Fullerton, California, Brea Improv with Brad Williams.
Yes.
Get your tickets at BreaImprov.com.
The About Last Night crew will be at the Brea Improv
March
20th through the 23rd.
Yeah, but by the time this comes out, I will be on Craig Ferguson doing some stand-up comedy on March 13th. And my album, Pop-Tart Suicide, comes out, I think, the day that this podcast will launch.
Wow.
March 11th?
March 11th, yeah.
So, hey, go to iTunes or Amazon or my website, AdamRayTV.com, and pick up a copy.
Yes, please do that. Please support our boy, Adam Ray. If you want to support me, follow me on Twitter, at FunnyBrad, and check me out March 13th through the 16th. I'll be at Captain Brian's Off the Hook Comedy Club in Marco Island, Florida. The aforementioned Brea Improv, March 20th through the 23rd. Hometown shows, love doing that. And then I'll be going out for the first time March 27th through the 29th. I'll be at the Comedy Club on State in Madison, Wisconsin. Definitely looking forward to that gig. For all their dates, go to bradwilliamscomedy.com. Touring all year. So hopefully I'll see you guys out on the road. And always love it when you come up to me after the shows and say, we love the podcast.
Yeah, that happens more and more, and it's pretty... It's pretty awesome. Because I guess, you know, you forget. Cool. It's like the listeners aren't here live with us. I mean, we're lucky enough to have the Neilan family as an audience for this episode, which is nice. But not everyone's family comes with them to the podcast. This was a treat.
That, you know what, that's what we should do. We should just take the podcast on the road and perform it in living rooms across the country and just watch.
Yeah, but will there be
we should watch 6-year-olds everywhere do impressions.
Doing it living color.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but will there be guaranteed jelly bean service at all of these?
Ooh, see, that's where
jelly bean service sounds like they might be playing at the Troubadour on Friday. So
I think they are. They're a great live band.
Yeah, and they're a Hootie and the Blowfish cover band.
They're
amazing.
Definitely stepped it up with the jelly beans and stepped it up with the podcast. So sit back, relax. How about that transition?
Worst segue ever.
Oh,
but
best transition then absolutely.
Transition Williams is your new name.
That is my name.
Yeah. No, but it was great.
And with all the info out of the way, let's get to the podcast. Please sit back and enjoy Mr. Kevin Neilan.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. It's about last night.
This area is gorgeous, by the way. Do you jog around here?
I don't walk.
I don't work.
I usually do late at night. I put the headsets on and listen to.
What's your power walk jam?
Usually it's hang on a second.
Hug that mic as much as you can too, Kev.
It's the what's the
Susu Studio by Phil Collins? How does that
go on
your...
I go on Pandora.
Oh yeah.
And I will listen to either Lady
Gaga?
No,
Lady and the Tramp soundtrack?
Antebellum.
Lady Antebellum, yeah.
Oh wow. So it's very sweet.
That's where I am right now, yeah.
Okay.
I like ballads when I'm walking.
That's got to be the name of your next book.
Or I'll listen
comedy
to, you know, your podcast.
Oh, look at that.
Wow.
To Mark Maron's podcast.
Sure.
Yeah.
Maron or Marone?
I think you could probably, well, you seem like you're probably chummy with
Marone,
him. Yeah, in France, it's Marone.
And I'll listen to Howard Stern on XM.
Stern is one of my faves, and I only got into him like 5 years ago. Have you been listening to him from?
I used to listen to him on terrestrial radio, and then when he went to XM, I said, well, bye-bye.
Yeah.
You know, and then I had a rental car somewhere a couple years ago, and they had XM in it, and I flipped it on to Howard Stern, you know, and I thought, oh, there's that voice I remember so well.
Right.
And I liked it, and I got XM.
Is that kind of a trip to now be on his show after all? I mean, like, that seems like, you know, like SNL, something you've watched for a long time, and then you get on it. Like, Stern's probably got to have some of the same.
Well, you know, there's not a lot of shows like that anymore, but Stern was like that for me because I listened to him for a long time, and I would never go near doing his show because I don't want to be put in the hot seat,
right?
You know, with all those.
Well, because he does grill his interview. Like, he definitely knows how to ask the right questions and gets you to admit, like, wow, I was going on there to promote a kids' show, and now I talked about having a threesome. I don't know why I did that.
So I kind of avoided that show. And then Susan, my wife, and I, a couple years ago, we said, let's start confronting some of our fears, you know.
Okay.
So,
and Stern was on the list.
Stern was on the list, the Bill Maher show.
Power walking to ballads.
Power walking to ballads. So, you know, I did both of those shows in the last couple of years, a couple of times, and it was a thrill. It was like, you know, to do the Stern show the first time, it was like afterwards, I kind of like, there was a real buzz, you know, for me because I avoided it so long.
Now, did you see like the popularity, like the ripple effect as far as like people, like new fans coming out of the woodworks?
A lot of people in our industry listened to him.
In fact,
just the other day, my wife and I had a meeting over 20th Century Fox because the head of comedy over there heard me on Howard Stern.
No shit.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Do you think Stern is kind of like the closest thing that we have to what The Tonight Show was with Johnny?
It's kind of different, you know, but it's...
Well, because you've done both.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can compare.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, I think material-wise and format-wise, it's kind of different. And, you know, they're both obviously different interviewers. But I think for the, you know, the thrill I got from it, it was similar, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, there's a lot of great talk shows out now. You know, Jimmy Kimmel, everybody's, you know, they're all different and they're unique and they're good. But there's nobody really like Johnny Carson anymore.
Right.
With that kind of...
To have that power to go, you are now...
Yeah.
You are now famous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you will now sell tickets on the road because I have given you the okay sign. Was The Tonight Show, when you did it, was that something that, like, nowadays the show groomers will tailor your set and they'll work with you for, like, 3 to 6 months. Was that how it was with you and Johnny?
No,
or was
not
that
at
just
all.
Like a spur of the moment thing?
No, I think I had auditioned for that show, you know, way before I was ready a couple of times. Whenever Jim mm-hmm. McCauley, who was the talent coordinator, would be in the club, everybody would be panicked and
they'd
either leave or they'd want to get on set, you know, get on the stage. And I, you know, I would, when I auditioned for him a few times, I had sweat coming out of me that never came out before.
Yeah.
The back of my legs was dripping, you know.
Yeah, that's usually the biggest.
But I never got on there. You know, I never mm-hmm. could pass that thing. And then he wanted me to audition for a show called The Mike Nesmith Show.
Okay.
From the Monkees. Remember him?
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
He was
one of the catchiest songs. You should power walk to that song.
Oh, man. I would be done in 5 minutes. So I auditioned for his show doing what I thought would be funny, not what I thought The Tonight Show would like. And he called me the next day. He says, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is you're not right for the Nesmith show. But the good news is I love that set for The Tonight Show. Can you do it in 3 days?
3 days?
Yeah. I remember I was going to Houston to do the laugh stop there.
Yeah.
And so I went to Houston. And from that moment when he said that until I did the show, it was a loop in my head. The 5 minutes I was going to do on the show over and over and over again. Over and over.
And you run it like, try to get it up as much as possible.
Yeah.
Just to get it out. And
well, the problem was I was in Houston doing, I had to do like 45 minutes to an hour. So I couldn't do just my 5 minute set.
Yeah.
Right?
You can't tailor that because that 5 minute set is a best of.
I was going to ask about that because I'm doing Ferguson for the first, it's my first late night thing next week. And I'm going to St. Louis this weekend to, you know, do the Funny Bone. And I was like, oh, well, I'll do that five at some point, but it's all, you know, it's jokes from different parts of my hour. So I'm like, I can't do just five and then move on with it. So how do you?
But you've been doing it long enough, so you're comfortable with just
any tips with the late night.
Well, drink a lot of water before you go out there, because when the curtain opened up, when I was waiting for the curtain to open up, I could hear the band playing, and you know, then they come back from commercial, and Johnny and Ed are, you know, the kibitzing a little bit, then they introduce me, and I walk out there, and from the curtain to my mark on the spot, I forgot my act.
What the?
I could not think of my act because I knew Johnny was there and there's the band playing.
Just overwhelming sensations of the whole experience.
And this is like you say, a 5 minute set that for the last 3 days has never left your head.
Right.
You've gone through it a million times.
I could be talking to you now and it looked like I was listening to you, but really I'm going over my act in my head.
Right.
You know? You have so little time to look like you don't know what you're doing. Cause I mean, you have a little bit of time as you're walking out and then maybe as the you know, clapping dies down to just say something.
That's exactly what happened. You know, by the time the clapping died down, it came back to me.
Oh my God. What if it didn't? What would are we able to separate in your brain? Like, what am I going to say?
Well, I think there was a comic on, I'm sure there's more than one, but, I think there was a comic that it happened to turned in and he said, I'm sorry, I forgot my act.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he say those actual words, but if that happens, do they go, all right, well, let's just take five and go again? Or
it is taped. The show is taped.
Oh, okay.
So they could do that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, now it's like, you know, I didn't even have like a cheat sheet in my pocket or anything, and there's no bullet points. Now when you do a talk show, they have a prompter with your bullet points.
Even for your specials, right? Like, won't they have a little thing with bullet points?
You could if you wanted,
Yeah.
But it was just I've never had such a natural high like that, you know, from doing it to in between when I did it and when it aired. Mm-hmm. I was just floating. It's just I was praying for no natural disaster, no tragedy.
Sure.
And,
right.
But every step of the way was, I mean, just the first laugh, the first applause break.
You remember all those
Johnny,
things.
Yeah. Hearing him laughing behind me.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to ask, what was that like when you're hearing?
Oh, it's just it was just euphoria. And you work so hard to get to that point. And then I remember being done and just doing a little glance over to Johnny, not looking for anything, you know, and him giving the okay thing. And
there
then
you go.
Going behind the curtain, and Jim McCauley, who was the talent coordinator, waiting back there, so proud, a big smile on his face. And he goes, you know, he was just happy for me, you could tell. And then he said, okay, stay close. I think Johnny's going to want to talk to you.
Oh, man.
And then in your head, you're like, wait, I just...
I need more?
I just had 5 minutes. That's all I got, kid.
Yeah. He says, well, when they come back from the commercial, he wants to talk to you. So just go out there, have fun. And, you know, you've got a lot of good stuff left. So so I went out there, and it was just so loose. And
hey, you must have been so loose at that point. Because it could have... I was going to say, like, you... So once you got... You remembered your act... It was just like,
oh, yeah.
Now I'm fine.
This is all extra credit now.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because you almost, you just avoided a catastrophe.
Yeah.
So now when you're on the couch with them, you're just like, oh, I mean, we could, you're so loose. And
yeah, yeah.
And what
so
was
I remember,
the first,
I remember
like,
the first joke I said to him that just, he. I remember he was still had smoke in his lungs. He was letting it out, you know, and he said, well, what's it like working on the road? You know, and I said, you know what? It gets a little lonely sometimes, Johnny. And at the time, there was, an AT&T commercial back then that said, you know, the next best thing to... you know, is being with somebody is calling long distance.
Okay.
So I said to Johnny, I said, you know what, Johnny? But, it, you know, I said, it is a little lonely, but you know what they say? The next best thing to being there is being with someone that looks similar. Anyone? That going back.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And that's perfect. And you, as a performer in that era, to see Johnny throw his head back and laugh, you're like, cha-ching, cha-ching.
It was like the comedic Zapruder film, where it went back and then came forward again.
and you just get that tape and you break it down. Here exactly is where the joke hit Johnny and forced his head back.
Yeah. I can imagine it's the same type of feeling like when those women go to an Oprah taping and they get a free gift.
Yes.
Like the amount of adrenaline that's going through your body.
Yeah. But I wasn't even thinking any of the time. I was just thinking, I'm here with Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
And I've become a stand-up. Right. I really felt like I was a stand-up then, you know.
Yeah.
How many years in was that?
It was about 6 years in.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Wow. 6 years. Yeah. And then, and that's something that probably from day one, you were just like, that's the goal.
That's the goal.
That's the goal, is to get on the Tonight Show. And then did Doors magically open up right after that, or were you just waiting by the phone? And then
I got out of the business after that.
Go out on top.
I was very surprised. I thought things would happen after that.
Like, well, I peaked.
I heard somebody say that, you know, it's never a one night thing where you get you have to keep going back and pounding it and pounding it. And that's what you do. You know, you do your first 5 minutes, and then maybe you have like 12 good minutes left after that. Your whole act. So every time you do the Tonight Show, as soon as you finish, you're thinking, okay, what's my next five? I got to start working on that. Working on that.
I heard you say on Stern that when you started stand-up that you were doing jokes from Highlights magazines? No. What was that?
It was from the back of the Parade magazine.
Right.
They would have a section called My Favorite Jokes. I wouldn't do those on stage at a club.
Right.
That was just in the neighborhood. You know, like friends, I would tell jokes.
That's how you started to find that you were funny with
people? Yeah, that's how I kind of... I used to like doing practical jokes. You know, they have the fake puke you can put on the floor.
Kev, you're speaking my language.
Yeah,
I got in trouble because in fourth grade on April Fool's Day, our 6'5" teacher, Mr. Berger, nobody would screw with him, but I put the whoopee cushion on his chair for him to sit down during silent reading, the ice cube with the fly in it in his coffee, and the fake puke on the side of his desk, and he came
in. Sounds like a good party.
And every kid knew because he left. I was coming back from recess, and so every kid's there, and everyone's watching me like lay it all out, and like the whoopee cushion, like his butt cheeks hit it at the perfect ratio to where it made the ultimate whoopee sound. He does that, then he goes for his coffee and goes, God damn it, sees the ice cube in there, and then sees the puke and just goes, Ray.
Oh, so you had a reputation at that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You were the guy.
Yeah, I was pulling all
sorts. And then
sorts
you escalate to doing the real stuff, real puke. Yeah.
That's what college is for. Yeah.
That's
you're
why I got fired from Albertsons.
Yeah, then you're actually farting on people's heads.
Wait, what was your go-to gag, though? Like your...
Oh, I had the brandy snifter. A snifter that looked like it had a beer brandy in it, but it was really closed on the top. So the brandy wouldn't come out when you pretended to throw it at somebody.
Wow.
I love that so much.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it's molded in.
Yeah.
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 What about the fake gum ever that snapped you? You ever pull that one?
No. I like the buzzer.
Yeah, the buzzer's always great.
And classic.
The back of a comic book magazine.
The gum one always seemed a little bit too aggressive, like you actually had a genuine hatred for the person, because that snapped your finger with a lot of...
It hurt?
There is a point where some of these things can be, you know, dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, here is the the stun gun.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the old taser trick.
That's, yeah, it's like, yeah, yeah, but then they lose control of their bowels. It's hilarious. Yeah. as they're dying on the floor.
Here's the surprising bear trap.
See, and that's the thing.
Put it in McDonald's ball pit.
Now I'm going to sound like an old guy. It's because now it's like all the YouTube stuff and all sort of like the jackass stuff. It's always like, it's just walk up to someone, punch them in the balls. That's a prank. It's like, no, you have to do what Adam Ray did and perfectly place a whoopee cushion.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, if you hit it the wrong angle, gets no sound whatsoever. No, you have to have it with him.
There's a lot of strategy. Perfect. Wait, so the parade joke. So you go gags.
I memorized the.
Yeah.
There were jokes like Stanley Myron Handelman.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he was a great misdirection comic.
You're brilliant at.
Mm-hmm. I think comedy is kind of like verbal magic. You know, you're fooling people. It's surprise. It's shock. It's
sure.
You know, going a different way than people think you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great at that. I remember he had a joke where he said, it was about how he got this crippled guy. He had an old stick for a walking cane, and he got a wish from a genie. He could have one wish. What would it be? And he made the wish, and all of a sudden his walking stick turned into a real crutch.
ain't no school like the old school, kid.
No, sir. Or here was another one. You guys hear about this guy? He stole a fire truck.
Okay.
And I would really personalize it. I would walk up to my friends and say, it would be like a circle at a party, and say, hey, man, did you guys hear about this guy downtown? He stole a fire truck.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wait for the reaction. No, really? I said, yeah. They said, what happened? I said, well, he was arrested 2 hours later by some guy who stole a cop car.
Neyland.
Yeah.
And when was the point when you thought, hey, I'm not just the funny guy. Like, I think I could actually do this.
Well, I went.
Yeah, everybody's got a point.
Spring break to, I think it was either Daytona or Jacksonville, Florida.
I was hoping you were going to say like Burbank or Bakersfield.
It was either Burbank or Miami.
Spring break, Springfield, Illinois. All right.
That has never been
Community
said
College.
By anybody.
Yeah. So I go down there, and I think it was Daytona. And at the time, this thing was popular where you go in and they take a picture of you and they put it on the front of the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the place that had it had a big front glass window. And I go in there, and there's no business. The guy's not having anybody come in. So I go in there, and I'm sitting in the chair. You know, he goes, come on in, come on in. So I sit in the chair, and they have a video thing up there, and I'm just making different faces. You know, I'm doing this for like 5, 10
classic
minutes.
Classic Neyland faces.
To my couple friends that are outside.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, I look outside the window, and there's like a big crowd of people laughing and watching.
Hilarious.
You know? And then
you had no idea, though.
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, you're just doing it.
But I got scared when I saw that. Cause, you know,
so a two-person audience you were comfortable with.
Well,
your friends.
My friends, yeah. But that's when I thought, wow, you know, that's like performing right there.
Totally.
You know, I kind of like
these people who you've never met and then all of a sudden they're finding what you're doing funny.
Yeah.
You're pulling eyes away from the caricature artist and the bearded lady. You're like, hey, look at these faces.
You know what my friend used to do with the caricature artist? Because I worked at Universal Studios, you know, for 7 years.
That's where I know you from.
Yeah, it's Wolverine. Yeah, I probably have. There's probably a picture of me with your family. If
you know what I thought would be a really... crazy job is I was just down in Orlando and there's a place called Holy Land where they reenact the crucifixion every night.
Oh my
God. The 12 stations.
They reenact the crucifixion.
The actor who has to do that every night and carry the cross.
So you think he walks into like a bar or something and goes, you have no idea what my cross to bear is. And you're like, no, it's the actual cross.
Yeah. I got to go to work. Oh, I'm so hungover. So you're down there, you're working at Universal.
Yeah, I was working at Universal, but there's always a caricature artist at these theme parks, and there's the guy who, I was just about to say, Shrek would do this, but he has a real name. His name is David, and he would walk by when he, it was before they had Shrek, like in a mask that was covering his face, and was kind of his open face, and he would walk by and look at the people, because you know the caricature artist was always, you know, on the opposite end of you, and he'd look to where the person could see them, and they were trying to be still to pose. And then he would walk around the side and look at the picture and then just go, ugh, and then just keep walking. And people would always break. And then the guy's like, no, don't move, don't move. Yeah,
I love caricature artists.
They're incredible.
I want to be one.
Yeah. I mean, as a dwarf, I hated them because they would always...
You're a dwarf?
Yeah, believe it or not.
I mean, this is it. This is as tall as you're getting.
That's it.
Wow.
Not getting any bigger.
Are you sure?
Well, not with that attitude. You know what? I mean, there's really... What if you just like... I mean, like, going back to the genie in the wish thing, like, what if one day you just woke up and you were like, I don't know, 5'8"?
Oh, I'd have to write a whole new act. that would suck. You're like, there goes that hour.
Here's my guess. You know, people that are deaf don't want to be able to hear because they're used to that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Same with people that are blind. I think they don't care about seeing.
Really?
Is it the same with you? You don't care if you're deaf or blind?
I really could give a shit about being deaf and blind at this point. It's like, because this has become is normal. So I don't know. But so, like, whenever I would sit down and the family would be like, all right, let's do the caricature artist thing, they always make whatever feature you have
big.
Like, bigger. So my head is just like the size of a cannonball.
The body's so small.
And the body's like tiny as hell, and then the butt's really big. And sure.
You have a great butt.
I bet always eventually turn to Brad and his size.
Absolutely. Let's talk more about everyone.
Hey, I think with the first few, Brad did a show with John Stamos and Saget at the K-Rock Kevin and Bean show, and that was one of the first episodes after he did that, and Stamos apparently is afraid of little people.
Really? Yeah.
So Brad went up to him, and there's a picture of Brad holding his leg and a look in Stamos' face of, I don't know if I'm going to turn into stone in a couple minutes here. Like, this just terrifying.
Well, you're a celebrity without even being a comic.
Yeah.
What?
That's true.
Yeah.
I am?
Oh, yeah.
People love little people.
They love
Stamos.
Brad and I were doing Pechanga Casino, and we're walking around the lobby, and little did I know, he had given a speech to this Japanese convention earlier that day.
Oh, to try to sell tickets for the show that night, like this Japanese gambling convention. And they're like, hey, get the comic out here to like say something. So I told the people that if you rub a dwarf's head, it's good luck.
For gambling.
For gambling. So all these like Japanese people are like climbing over themselves. They're like, no, I must rub the midget head. And like they're all like,
that's an Italian guy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm terrible at impressions. So like they're all climbing up, and then later that night we're just hanging out.
We're walking through the lobby, and literally every Japanese person starts rubbing Brad's head. I had no idea what happened previously in the day, so I'm like, hey man, Brad, and Brad's not even, he's like talking to me as they're rubbing his head. He's not even breaking conversation to like acknowledge the head rub. And I also noticed I was like, hey man, like, is that like one of their own? Did they create that superstar? Are they like, did I miss something? He's like, I don't know. Like, I did this.
It's a good thing that it's like, you know, you beat up the midget. That's good luck.
Yeah, I chose my words very carefully. But then the fact that they actually did it made me think like, wow, I should have like aimed for the stars a little bit. Like, hey, if you give a dwarf $1 million, you win a million more.
I mean,
take my money at this point.
Yeah.
Take my money at this point.
How did your show at the Laugh Factory come about?
And this is a new material night.
New material night.
Yeah.
I don't really remember, but
every Tuesday at 8, right?
Jamie, the owner, and I were talking about doing a show in there, and I think we just thought it would be, because initially I wanted to come down and kind of work on new material.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And but then when you get down there, you realize that you haven't really worked on anything new.
Right.
Yeah.
Now it's time to be on.
But you're so great conversationally, and I mean, you know, I've told you this on a handful of occasions that, and hopefully like that is, you doing that show is prep for you to have a show at some point, because feel like to be a talk show host, you have to be likable. You have to be a good listener, but also be able to always be in control, because there's some people that will get up there that I'm sure, you know, like when you're interviewing that just, hey, aren't as comfortable in that setting. I mean, I think I was the first time I did it with you and luckily you were so good at being able to, if I had minimal responses, to take that and make it funny or find another direction that maybe you could get something out of me.
No, you're always good on it. But there's some people that they don't know how to talk one-on-one when they're on stage. It's more, they're continuing with their performance. So they're performing to the audience instead of having a conversation.
Right, right.
And understanding that could be entertaining as well.
Sure.
And that takes time. You know, it's doing a talk show, I mean, I've been doing them for over 30 years. It takes, you know, a while to get, you know, that rhythm down and that comfort zone where you're just able to relax and have a conversation and be funny.
And trust yourself that you don't have to come in with planned bits and just...
Yeah. And I know when I first started, I had everything memorized what I was going to say.
Yeah.
You know, and waiting for the question.
If you go back and watch that footage, can you see it on your face of just like
the
wheels turning of...
But now I kind of, even when I have a pre-interview and then you know what they're going to ask you, I still like to try to go off of that course and steer it another way to make it real.
And that's when you create those genuine moments. I mean, some of the classic bits on the Tonight Show came from just organic stuff just coming up, and then that's the stuff that makes like the whole best of thing. And now, in like you said, you've gone on shows now for 30 years, so you've been on Tonight Show with Carson. Did you ever do the Magic Hour?
What's the Magic Hour?
With Magic Johnson.
Oh no, I didn't. But I think he wanted me to be his sidekick.
What? Oh no, kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, so it was like between you and the Love Master, Craig Shoemaker.
I don't know who was between at the time, but it was maybe in the initial.
That's
stages.
Incredible.
But yeah, I've been on almost every talk show that's been out there, from John Davidson to Alan Thicke.
Alan Thicke had a show?
Yeah, he had a show.
Mike. He would just open every show like that.
Who else? Howie Mandel had a show.
Yeah.
Holy crap!
Rosie.
Roseanne Barr.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Bonnie Hunt.
Bonnie Hunt. Whiskey mug in the cupboard.
Really?
Rosie O'Donnell, another celebrity who's afraid of little people.
What?
Yeah, she's afraid of little people too.
We have to come out with a list.
I know.
And, you know, blog about.
Yeah, that's a BuzzFeed list I'd like to see on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
William's list.
Yeah. just line them up.
And then just have an all-star podcast show with all
what
the people.
What is it that people are afraid of? I mean, they have a phobia.
Loving too much?
Maybe they think it's contagious.
I think maybe some people are used to seeing like a certain form.
Yeah.
And they're, mm-hmm. and then when there's a minority like of little people.
Yes.
They think, oh, that doesn't register to what.
Oh, yeah. We call it a murder of little people.
A murder?
Yeah.
Oh, is that what a flock, like a flock of little people?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you really?
Maybe.
I will now.
I think it'd
gaggle.
Be awesome.
Yeah. Gaggle of little people.
Gaggle of dwarves. Now, when you're doing stand-up, is Saturday Night Live a thought in your head? Is it a goal? Or is that something that happened sort of on a completely different path?
When I'm doing stand-up? No. When I was doing stand-up, I was doing it to do stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
I had no other goal in mind except to be a good stand-up comic.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I used to hang out at the Improvisation on Melrose when I first moved out here, because that was the hub of comedy. And I remember Mark
moved out here from from where? Where'd you move from?
From Connecticut.
Gotcha.
All right.
But Mark Lanau, who was used to hang out at the club at the time, he later became partners with Bud Freeman. He kind of took an interest in me, and I remember one day he said, "Do you want to do any acting?" And for some reason, I was embarrassed to say, "Yeah, I would try acting." I said, "I don't know, maybe."
Why? What was your notions of
it
actors?
It just seemed like the people that you know that acted in theater, you know, in the college, and
collected mugs and put them in their cupboards.
Yeah. They were just kind of weirdos, you know, stuff.
Yep. Oh, I was in theater school. I know all about those people.
Yeah,
sure.
So he said, you should take some acting classes because one day you're going to be doing your stand-up and somebody's going to walk in there, a casting person is going to want to have you come in and audition. So I did that. I started taking cold reading classes and acting workshops.
Well, it's perfect because we have a couple scenes we'd like to read a cold read tonight.
Beautiful.
Yeah, we have a great scene from Glenn Ross.
Yeah, and if that's not, and if you can't tackle that, we have Air Bud 4 and 5.
I could do Glenn Gary Jeff Ross.
Gregory Jeff Ross.
It works better at a roast.
Great. Yeah. Way better. So
what was like one of your first auditions or
I could say my first TV show was that for with acting was Scarecrow and Mrs. King. It was a show that was on back then with Kate Jackson, one of the Charlie's Angels.
Whoa.
No kidding.
I played a security guard.
All right.
I remember there was one of the words in my dialogue was incendiary.
Whoa.
And I had so much trouble remembering how to say it. Incendiary.
They had a security guard say the word incendiary? Who wrote this thing?
Please tell me you were a recurring character.
Somebody started a fire at some warehouse, and they were interviewing me as the security guard. And I was saying something like, and that's where we found the incendiary.
When would a security
guard... Record that into my phone. I want that to be my email alert.
When would a security guard ever say that? Be like, man, and this shit got hot.
Yeah.
That's when they had white security guards.
Now, going into that, with like your lack of experience, were you like thinking that like, I got to get this word right because I'm only going to get one shot? Or like,
well, no,
should I
do a
security...
Takes, but, okay. You know, but I remember it was my first acting job, so I was a little nervous about it. But and then
did you try to put on like a security guard voice or anything? Any sort of backstory?
No, I just did my own voice. I didn't try anything special. No risks.
It's like just did me.
Yeah, I did me. Because nobody heard me before.
Sure,
they didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
Oh, who's he doing? He's created a character.
There you go. And then, like, how does that develop? And did someone come up to you after a show and said, "Hey, I think you should be on Saturday Night Live"?
I can't remember what happened. Oh, Saturday Night Live?
Yeah.
Oh, that was, well...
I like that we're just saying, like, yeah. So you did the security guard, then Lorne Michaels was there and goes, "Hey, man, I've never seen
someone..." I like the way you say incendiary.
Oh, Kevin, I really like the way you say incendiary. That's a terrible impression, but whatever.
It's true. Everybody has a Lorne Michaels, though, right?
They do. Yeah. They do. No, the Saturday Night Live thing, okay, here's what happened.
Yeah.
I was not even pursuing that job because I was a stand-up. You know, I wasn't a sketch artist or an impressionist, characters. But Dana Carvey was up for the show at the time, and we shared a house when he was in town. He would rent a studio apartment over the garage in this house we lived in the Hollywood Hills.
That's
it was
awesome.
Me, another comic, Bob Duback, and Joe Kenny, a writer friend of mine. And Dana would be around a lot. And so I knew him from stand-up comedy, you know, over the years. And we used to kind of be in the driveway and we'd do characters kind of stuff, you know, just riff off each other. And he got the show that summer and he was going to be moving to New York, you know, later in the summer. And then Jan Hooks was also up for the show at the time. And at the time I was dating her, we had been friends for a long time too. And I was reading Backstage Live, Saturday Night Live, and I was excited for them. I was really excited and wondering how it was all going to turn out.
And you've been a fan of the show at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I love the show. And no idea that I would ever come into play on it.
Jeez.
And so Dana goes to New York, and he calls me one day. He's in, he says, "Kev, I'm out at Lorne Michaels' house in Amagansett. I'm in the back bedroom. Guess who's in the kitchen? It's Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd."
Okay.
Anyway, I told Lorne about you. I think they're going to want to see your tapes because they're looking for one more cast member.
Oh, my God.
I said, "You're kidding me. Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd are in the kitchen?"
What are they eating? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't think anything of it. I'll never get on there. You know, it's a nice gesture, but it's not going to happen for me. Because you couldn't get an audition if you didn't have like a powerful agent in L.A.
How did Danny get his?
He had a powerful agent.
There you go.
He was with Brad Grey at the time, manager. And I always kind of wanted to be with Brad Grey as my manager.
Sure.
But he had his hands full at the time, he told me. So I sent my tape in. Week goes by. I get another call from Dana. I'm back out at Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's out in the kitchen? It's Paul Simon and Steve Martin.
Whoa.
You're kidding me. Anyway, I think Lorne liked your tape. I think he's going to fly in. Steve Martin's in the kitchen.
Dude, I feel like those conversations just escalate to where he's like, the next week, it's like, guess who's in the kitchen? The cast of Fraggle Rock and, you know, Bill Clinton.
This is just like a Lifetime miniseries. Who's in Lorne Michaels' kitchen?
Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi's out in the kitchen.
He hasn't touched a thing.
So I think it's a waste of time, but I'll humor them, you know.
I'm glad
they like the tape. And
he liked the tape at this
point. They like the tape. And so they fly me in. And I think it's just going to be me and a couple other people because there's only one spot. But, of course, you know, typical of Hollywood, it's the whole plane is full of people going to audition.
Jeez,
people
right.
from the Groundlings and Second City. Even the pilot came out of the cockpit. He goes, "Hey, you think this is funny for my audition?" And so I got
this character. He's a pilot.
Yeah, he's a guy who doesn't fly planes and pitches characters while the plane's nosediving.
I go to 30 Rock, and I'm not nervous at all because I know I'm not getting it because I don't do characters or sketches.
It's a great, also really healthy mentality to have going in, right?
Oh, it was perfect. Yeah. It was perfect. And everyone else is pacing, and they're sweating, and they're nervous. And then I go into Studio 8H where they film the show, and I do my my little audition kind of off to the side. It was on the floor. I remember it wasn't on the stage. It was on the floor at the end of the bleachers, and they had a camera set up. And it was the people that were already on the show for that year. It was Nora Dunn, John Lovitz,
Jeez.
Dennis Miller, Dana Carvey was there, and Lorne Michaels. And they're all sitting behind the camera, and they're watching. And I'm just doing my stand-up and a couple of things that Dana and I used to do in the driveway, you know, of our house. And I leave, and I think, oh, that was fun, you know?
Yeah, got to go to New York.
New York, yeah.
So no characters. You just did some bits of you guys
I think so.
Talking through stuff? Like, this would be funny almost?
Yeah, I think we...
No Hans and Franz?
No Hans and Franz, no, nothing. It was, I think we used to do a couple of characters, like porno characters.
Nice.
Like they would talk to each other when they're sitting in the director's chair getting made up. You know, it's just like in between scenes saying, hey, Johnny, We should go. We should go have pizza next week and go do some bowling. Oh yeah, but make it nice for the. You know, we talked to the makeup artist about how she's putting the makeup on our, you know, on our package.
Yeah,
put some pinstripes on that. You know, make it nice for the people. It's always make it nice for the people.
For the people.
Yeah,
yeah. You cared about your fans.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So we'll go. We'll get some pizza and we'll go down there and put a little sparkle on the side too. Right? That's good.
That must have crushed. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were all laughing. The thing is, I think what Lorne discovered that he needed people that could work well together, so they have to know each other. And mm-hmm. I knew Dana, I knew Dennis, and
did you know John Lovitz?
I didn't know John Lovitz, but we all had a chemistry, I think, and that's what
I think he's funny, Lorne.
Jealous.
So no, did you have the same type of nervous feelings you did at the Tonight Show when you walked out on that stage at Saturday Night Live?
Oh, not at all.
No.
Oh, you mean the first day? The first
for the audition?
Oh, for the audition. No, but the first. Night that we shot the show was actually, it's funny how you can kind of rationalize and make yourself relaxed. You think of different scenarios. Like for me, I thought nobody's really watching this show anymore, and they really weren't. The ratings were, it was almost canceled the season before we came in.
Was that like the Robert Downey Jr. cast?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't his cast, but...
Right, it was the cast.
He was one of the cast members, yeah. Yes.
He came in there and said, this is my show now. Yeah. You don't even know this. I'm gonna be Iron Man one day.
Yeah. So I would tell myself, nobody's watching it. It's probably just the people in the room. And I was used to people in a room because I did stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a small room in there. And there's a lot of cameras. And I remember waiting to go on. And we're coming back from commercial. This is my first sketch. It's Mr. Subliminal. Which is
that
difficult.
Was your first sketch?
Oh my God!
You got like two conversations going on at once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, iconic now, which is crazy to think about.
And so Lorne comes up next to me just before we're about to come back live, like 5 seconds. The stage manager's counted down 4, and Lorne goes to me. He goes, "Are you sure this is what you want?"
What? Before your first show?
Yeah.
God, he's so art of war. He's nuts.
I hear he does that too, where he'll kind of plant little seeds like that in people's heads to kind of give them a little mind.
Well, I think it's more of his sense of humor.
Okay,
you know, it's kind of.
So does that make you panic?
So he can tell Chevy Chase in the kitchen one day, guess what I told Kevin Nealon 5 seconds before he was going on. Yeah. Are you sure this is what you want? Ah, it was hilarious.
By the way, you're now one of those guys in the kitchen, which is like pretty.
That's
cool.
Right.
Hey, there you go.
Good night, everybody.
Take a break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover. That's okay. So you do the Subliminal sketch, and then it goes over great.
Yeah, it goes over well, and then we're on our way. You know, and the church lady was out there, and you know, it was just kind of the show is kind of reinventing itself again.
How long did it take for you and that cast to kind of feel like, oh, people aren't watching this to where you're like, I think
well,
we're crushing
that's a
it.
Good question. We were living out of our suitcase each week. We were expecting the show to be canceled.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, you just, it's that's the way the entertainment business, anyway, you really don't, you can't trust it. You never think it's going to be lasting, long lasting.
Well, I might just, you know, shut the laptop off any moment.
I know. Even with podcasts, you don't know if you're going to go the full hour.
Exactly.
Was there, and then who, okay, so then the cast, the show doesn't get canceled. And
doesn't
there,
get canceled. The ratings start picking up. People are talking about it. And, you know, we do 1 year, then another year. I did a total of 9 seasons on there.
9 seasons.
But it was kind of, I liken it to prison in a way where I saw like new inmates coming and going.
Right.
And I was there for like a lot of different changes, you know.
And your cast, so your cast starting off has Miller in it.
The original cast was Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, Victoria Jackson, Nora Dunn, Jan Hooks. And I was a feature player.
Now there's like twice as many in a cast, right?
Yeah.
Like that seems pretty small.
Yeah.
But that's an insane cast in terms of what they've done since. Like, like you look back and you're like, that's how did they not know it was going to be a hit? Because you guys weren't Nora Dunn,
established.
Kevin Nealon. Like you guys weren't then. But did... Were there any moments when, like in that first season, where you're just like you're looking at a Phil Hartman, going, "Holy crap, these people are just ridiculously talented."
Oh yeah, every day I would think I'm going to be discovered. I'm out of here. I'm gone. You know, I felt like do you know George Plimpton? He was a writer who would put himself into different scenarios to write about it. Like he'd become a football player. I think he wrote a book called The Paper Lion.
Okay,
and he would always like put himself into scenarios that he was not familiar with just to write about it.
That's awesome.
And that's kind of who I felt like I was. And
you felt like you were just some character, like, oh, yeah, this, someone's watching this and
all
just
these people,
laughing at it.
All these people were great sketch artists and impressionists.
You were coming from a stand-up background.
I was coming from stand-up, and so was Dana. But Dana did characters, you know.
I was just
going to
say, yeah.
Stuff.
Like Fallon came from stand-up, but he did impressions and characters in his stand-up.
Yeah. So it was really a thrill to kind of be around them and to learn and watch what happens.
But then you get Update, and you're probably like, all right, now I have like a specific role, right, that I'm...
Yeah.
Now I'm an integral part that...
But I remember I used to watch Joe Piscopo do stand-up comedy, you know, way back in New York, and then he got on the show, and all of a sudden I'm seeing all these characters, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I guess if you live in New York, you see a lot of characters in New York, and you could emulate those people.
Yeah, sure.
And that's pretty much what you do. You know, you go there, and you're thrown into this vat of, you know, comedy pressure, and you've got to come up and find
scraping
things
for something each week. I mean, yeah. I can't imagine, because you could probably come in with all of your, like, I have a couple buddies from SC who just got hired in this past year, and they come from a huge sketch improv background, and some of their things they've done over the past few years have gotten on the show, but, you know, not as much as I thought would already have been, where they would have been like, hey, all your great characters that you've done, let's bring them all to the show. So they're having to, like, come up with tons of new stuff, and I'm just...
You come up with anything you can think of, everything you know, you throw it out there. I would get to the point where I would walk through a video store and look at different titles on videotapes to see if that would spark something.
Anything. Wow. Yeah. And did it?
Sometimes. I came up with a thing for Robert Mitchum. He was hosting one year. And he did a lot of those shows, like the detective shows.
Unsolved Mysteries?
Not Unsolved Mysteries, but it was that film noir style back then. And so I did a parody of that called, this one episode was called Death Be Not Deadly, where he played that character. And he always did the voiceover stuff. I didn't know where this guy was coming from, but I was going to find out in the movie. So in the actual sketch, I made him doing the voiceovers, but really doing it in the room. And so I was in there as some like hitman thug, and he would be doing the voiceover, hiding behind like a plant of flowers. I don't know what this thug wanted, but I was going to. And I'd say, who are you talking to? Who are you talking to?
That's brilliant.
I mean, and that happens. I mean, like how much pressure is in that writer's room where you're just looking at amazingly talented people, and then Lauren goes to you and goes, and Kevin, what do you have? And you just like... is that just incredibly intimidating?
It's exhilarating because you have this opportunity to write something, create something, and have it air that week. And that's also the downfall of a lot of people that are on that show. I was there for 9 seasons, which was a long time.
Sure.
But a lot of people couldn't last, or they'll talk bad about it now, what a horrible experience it was, is because they put so much pressure on themselves to come up with a character each week, because you do have this great opportunity to get a character out there, or a catchphrase, or something that could be turned into a movie. And if a week goes by and you don't do it, you think, oh, man, what a waste. That's how I used to feel about drinking. If I didn't get drunk on the weekend, oh, that was a waste.
And also, if you do get a catchphrase or character on and it doesn't hit, but you're like, all right, well, next week I'll try again, and that one doesn't hit, and you get a little consistent streak of you know, strikeouts, then you're like, oh, geez, am I now in jeopardy of being... And then you're Farley, and you come in with, you know, what, I mean, 20 different... What was that? I'm curious because watching that guy live, obviously, like, you know.
I didn't know who he was. A lot of people didn't know who he was because he was working in Chicago, you know, Second City TV and on stage. And then he came, and I remember the day he walked in off the elevator. I think he was with his mother and his brother, and he was just that wide-eyed kid coming in. And, hey, how you doing, Mr. Nealon? You know, hey.
Yeah, he knows you.
And, very funny. I never broke character in sketches. Mm-hmm. One time, though, I came very close, and it was during the Chippendale sketch with Farley.
Oh, God. You
know, that might be, no joke, I'd easily say top two, because I know there's, but like that, because you guys are so straight that you feel like you're watching, and then Swayze's incredible. So you're like, I literally felt like I was watching tape from an audition, because I was like, how do you not break during that?
I know. Well, what I did was I would start staring at his stretch marks, and I would try to in my
head. That gets you not to laugh.
Yeah, no, I was making designs out of the stretch marks in my head.
You have like a Rorschach test of his stretch marks.
I was doing the same thing that prisoner of war people do. You know, prisoners do to try to stay sane.
Sure, right. Sure. Make Rorschach tests of stretch marks. Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty sure they teach you that in CIA interrogation training. That's one of those moments where that sketch and you guys being as straight-faced as you were creates the iconic nature of that sketch. Because if you guys are cracking up, now, you know, there's yeah.
They know what they're doing. They
know Farley's so committed that it's like, you know, you're like, you want this guy to get the job at the end of the sketch, and it's such a like a bummer. Well, okay, so when that first, so you were going to say you almost broke during that, or
yeah, but I didn't. And
what almost made you break? The dancing, obviously. Yeah, it was just too.
Yeah. Just the fat.
Did you even?
Basically, was the fat.
There's that
the
one fat shot where he does like the arms together, and it does a weird. Did you get to see that in dress rehearsal? Was that the first time?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you're like, all right, I'll be able to hold it together.
Yeah.
But then when you hear people laughing in the studio, right?
Yeah, it was. He was really funny. He was mostly because of his size and his attitude and his talent too. But yeah, it was all that combination of all that stuff. So many great sketches. I love the one he did with Paul McCartney, you know, the talk show.
Remember when you were in the Beatles? Yeah. That was really cool.
Was that fun?
You say love, the love you give is equal to the love you make. Is that true?
Stupid. And then... Then when moments like that happen,
I don't know if you're doing Chris Farley or not.
No, I'm doing Brad Williams, but it's, you know, people get the two confused all the time.
Are we out of that now?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. But like when those moments are happening, when he's doing a motivational speaker, when the massive head wound Harry is happening, when those iconic sketches are like, can you tell in that moment? They're like, can you say, oh man, this is something, or do you have to sort of wait for
the people? I know. The sketches from the table read.
Right.
And I'm starting to realize that all these people are coming in with, you know, pocket characters that they've done for years.
He did Second City.
Yeah.
And I have nothing. You know, I'm just there as myself. You know, I'm just kind of... So I did play straight guy in a lot of sketches. And
But that's why you were so great for Update, though. I mean, it's... And like that one when he had to... When they tried to make him fly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had to attach the hooks. Yeah. I mean...
And when... When Miller leaves and the Weekend Update chair is open, is that something that you thought to yourself, like, I can get that? Or did they come to you?
No, they came to me. Lauren always kind of wanted me in that spot up there.
Mm-hmm. And did they audition other people? Or was it just like, no, this is Nealon's. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you say
Dana called me from his Lawrence Michaels house. Says, I think they want a Weekend Update guy.
You never can believe who's in the kitchen.
Dan Rather. Really, Dan Rather's in the kitchen?
Yeah. Now he keeps asking why there's no more grape nuts.
Now you say you don't have characters, but the Subliminal Man character is an iconic character. Was that based on anyone, or was that just someone?
I'll tell you exactly where that came from.
Yeah,
I used to pretty much live at the Improv on Melrose. So much so that when friends would come out to visit, they say, where can we go? And I would say, well, I just know the Improv. You know?
Yeah.
And so I met a lot of interesting people down there. And this one particular guy, Ed Peck, his name was, he was a character actor. He did a lot of, he always played like the cops on Laverne and Shirley and
awesome.
Happy Days.
Yeah.
Really deep voice. He took a liking to me. And a lot of times we go to Cantor's after the club closed.
Great
with
call.
A bunch of different people. And
yeah.
He would go, and he told me about this thing he was doing called tagging, where he would slip a word in there, you know, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do it to the waitress, you know, and he told me he was going to do it. Okay. So it would be really, you know, things like, I think I'm going to have the French fries you're treating. Also, why don't you give me the hamburger, you whore, and just put a little bit of ketchup on it, slut. You know what I'm saying?
Would they ever pick up on it?
No, never.
Oh, my God. Oh my God.
And
because it was so low and just like...
Yeah. You bury it.
So, yeah, you bury it.
And so when I got to Saturday Night Live, I got together with Al Franken, and we combined the two.
Senator Al Franken?
Yeah.
Wait, and so you guys wrote that together? And then... Do you call Ed and tell him like, hey man, that
He was very excited about it.
Do you ask permission, or are you just like, hey, that thing?
Oh no, I asked them. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. You know that tagging thing you used to do? Well, we have an idea where we're gonna.
He must love to be able to tell people.
Oh, he loved it.
That's incredible. Yeah. And then Hans and Franz.
Hans and Franz, the same guy, Ed. And
seriously?
Yeah, no.
Holy crap, that guy's a gold mine.
Yeah, he came up with the church ladies. He did
Wayne's World,
everything. This guy he should have been on the show.
He's like, he's just sitting there going, that's all my bits.
Yeah. That would be a great documentary, though, if that was the real case. A guy who just fed, SNL stars and just created.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was you know, selfless like that, where he just came up with these great bits. And
the Hans and Franz bit, Dane and I came up with, we were on tour. with Dennis Miller one summer. It was like after our first year on there. And we were at a Red Lion Inn in Des Moines, Iowa.
All right, quit bragging.
And I was watching.
Yeah, we get it. They put you up.
We get it. Des Moines.
Yeah.
You're
Des Moines,
big time.
Yeah, SNL. Yeah.
I picked up Arnold Schwarzenegger that night.
Wow.
In a bar. No, I was watching. I was watching the Showtime up close and personal, and they were interviewing Arnold, and they would ask him what he did when he came into town. He goes, yeah, he was so specific about what he would do, and he goes, you know, I like to slip into the nice light cotton shirt, and then I go out in the town, and then I come back to the hotel, I slip into the nice light cotton sheet. So I called Dana.
Slipping into anything is a little creepy as an adult male.
So Dana and I watched that, and we kind of mimicked him for the rest of the tour, and we thought we got to come up with some characters before next season.
Because you couldn't stop just mimicking him because he's
doing
his
that voice.
Cadence and his voice.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I
slip into a slip and slide sometimes.
Slip and slides and things like that. Something like
that. Decent that and all of these things.
Yeah, all these things. You know what they do.
And that nature. He loves that one.
That nature. Yeah.
Things of that nature.
I was at a fundraiser once with him. I think it was at Planet Hollywood, and he had a good joke. He goes, and then my wife, she just got some plastic surgery. Yeah, I cut up her credit card. But
Arnold with the one-liners. Yeah.
So anyway, I used to live in Germany when I was a kid.
Oh, no kidding.
We could travel around and go to Austria and stuff. So I kind of knew, like, you know, Hans and Franz and names like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we all know Arnold. So we thought, why don't we come up with these two bodybuilders? Mm-hmm. Trainers that are so pathetic. They berate everybody, but yet they're such losers themselves. They never lift a pound and
right.
You know, they're out of shape.
Yeah.
And that's such a great premise. That's all you, when you're, I don't know, pitching it to writers, or you're writing yourself, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, once you get that, you're just like, all right, well, this is a home run. Like, cause
well, you know, we had so much fun writing those characters. That's when you know something is really funny. When you, every time you go to write it, you're just laughing like hysterically. You know,
if you think, you know, you're such a hot, you know, you think that, Mr. Perfect, you know, with the pompadour. But hear me now and believe me later. I can stretch your love handles into a bag and you can climb into the bag and clear yourself out of the trash, my friend.
Oh, my God. Dying at that.
And then you're dying at that.
And you're just like spitting it back and forth to each other and then being like, all right, that made me laugh, so write that down.
Yeah, we're writing that down.
And how long would it take you to write that sketch then?
Well, like, you know, even back then, it's like in 88, 87, there was no computers. You know, we were all writing everything
longhand
on LegalPad. Oh, and then we give it to the PAs, and they would type it up that morning. So we wrote the first one, and we weren't sure whether to, like, have really big muscles, you know, like look real, or just have, like, really fake, like, third world, you know, Russia kind of, like, stuffing in a simple gray T-shirt, you know, with the belt and everything.
Track suits, yeah.
And so we settled on that. And then we took it out there, and we performed it the first time to lukewarm reception. People weren't really sure what the...
Oh, wow. And is Arnold at this point just ridiculously famous?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was famous out of the womb, dude.
Yeah.
He just came out and he kicked out of the womb.
I slipped out of a nice placenta and I slipped into a nice,
nice
cotton
placenta.
So when it gets lukewarm, is that, can you go, does Lauren go, let's give it another shot?
No. So it sat there for a couple, you know, we didn't do it for a couple weeks, and then I suggested we do it again. And so we wrote up another one. And when we came out there, the audience went crazy.
Oh, my God.
They loved
it.
Rock star status.
But you never know. I mean, we could have very easily just said, forget that one. That's not.
What made you, just because you probably kept mimicking the...
Because it made us laugh so much.
Yeah.
You're like, this, and so you knew that was funny. You're like, this is funny. People will get this.
So what did you change about?
Pound it into their heads enough, they'll get it.
Did you change, like, the way, like, the back and forth?
We just, you know, changed the B rating lines, and, you know, we'd have something different theme each time.
Maybe it even took the audience, and I don't know if there's some truth in this, but, like, they saw it a second time, so they were like, it was a little more familiar, and they were a little more
on board. Yeah, they recognized it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were there in the audience at Saturday Night Live, and there's a sketch they recognized.
Because I feel like even the cheerleader sketch with Will Ferrell and Cher Terry, like, wasn't killer right off the bat. Like, but once it gained some recognition, and people were like, oh, I'm excited. I'm familiar. I
It's their friend. Yeah. There's that sketch they know. Yeah, you're right.
By those writer rooms, then, with just writing it long form, that's crazy. So, I mean, like, the legible... I mean, you had to really
write legibly, especially at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. on Wednesday morning.
Oh, you're running off of maybe 30 minutes of sleep.
And the thing about, they had some Harvard guys there, like Jim Downey was the head writer.
And Conan, right?
Conan came later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Al Franken.
Yeah.
But these guys are thinkers. They don't like to write until they actually know what's going on.
Oh, jeez.
Gotcha.
I like to write. As soon as I come up with a germ, I start writing it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like 4 a.m. and you're exhausted. And I said, Jim, can we please write this down on a piece of paper? Let's just. But what if character?
You know, no, too much.
I think, let's just write this down.
Yeah, yeah.
Sleep.
Just get it down.
Would you ever hear anything of Sandler, like a pitch in a writer's, like a sketch that you heard and you were just like, I mean, that's like, that's pretty silly. That's too silly. And then it would like crush or vice versa.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You always, you didn't understand why some things got on and some things didn't get on. Mm-hmm. Especially as the cast got bigger and there was more submissions and the table read on Wednesday would last for 4 hours or 5 hours.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
And if your sketch was near the end.
That's tough.
People are out of energy.
People are just tired at that point. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Would he play
Wednesday? It goes on. Yeah. And you're just doing the table read to figure out, like, people don't realize, like, how fast this show comes together.
I know.
I mean, you say it's a week. You're like, they have a week to do it, but you start on Wednesday.
Well, actually, I think they do know how long it takes now because people have talked about it so much. I think a person walking out on the street, you could say, when is table read on Saturday night? That's a Wednesday. You know, you stay up all night on Tuesday writing.
Yeah. They know the process, but it's still shocking to hear every time that you guys are able to do that just every week, just come up with new sketches,
and it, you know, it takes a toll on you after a while. You kind of pace yourself. It's more like a marathon. That's how you kind of survive. It's not a sprint. And I kind of knew after like 9 years that I kind of did it, and I got to the point where I knew it was time to move on because I was going out to do sketches with food in my mouth, still from the craft service table.
Oh, jeez.
You know, from the break.
So it kind of became routine for you? Did it kind of become?
It was never routine, but there was that. I didn't have that adrenaline or that fear that I had from the beginning.
It makes you raise your game, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then I jumped off of there to do a show called Champs. It was a Gary David Goldberg show that DreamWorks was producing. It was their first sitcom. And that lasted about 8 episodes.
Wow.
Did you have to say the word incendiary?
Incendiary.
Wow.
I mean,
well, that's why it didn't work.
Is that scary? Now, did you go to Lorne and say, "Hey, Lorne, I think I'm done"? Or
no,
okay.
No. I had this pilot that I wanted to do. So I asked Lorne. I said, "You know, I think I've been," and I think they were. You know, also you could tell from the writing and from the other people that are getting more airtime that your time was kind of up.
Right.
So the show has a natural way of kind of telling
it
like.
Does. Yeah, you kind of get on the horse and head out.
Now, how soon did you buddy with, because obviously, I mean, like your relationship with Sandler and him letting you pop up in a chunk of his movies is pretty awesome, and you always crush it. Like, did that relationship obviously start from SNL, or did it kind of
get? Yeah, I did. I met Sandler when I was on SNL. I went over to the comic strip one night.
Great club.
He was doing stand-up, and he was a big fan of mine. And
that's awesome.
And we walked from there to the Catch a Rising Star, and, you know, he was asking a lot of questions, so we had a good time talking. And then he went back and told all his friends at NYU the next day he met me, and it was a big thing, you know. And then he got on the show, and he would do the Weekend Update when I was on Weekend Update, and I was always very supportive. I think that's what he remembers, is that I was supportive of him being on Weekend Update. And
yeah, you're next to him as he's doing, like, the Cajun Man character, and just, like, going, oh, my God, this guy's crazy.
When audiences just lose it during that shit live, I mean, like the songs and
Opera Man. And
yeah, they love the Opera Man, Cajun Man, you know, any man you could think of.
Popsicle Man was a big hit.
Uh-huh.
Never got on, but table reads it crushed.
But I always wondered, like, after I left SNL, would there be anything that would be that monumentous, you know, that was that great that people would know me for?
Sure.
And after a while, I was thinking, that was it, man. That was my run until Weeds came along.
Oh,
you know? Which I was just telling Brad in the car, like, I watch, there's, you know, a handful of TV.
You guys,
like,
familiarize yourself with my career as you're driving over here. Okay, let's not forget Weeds.
Hey, no.
Wikipedia.
We watched Weeds.
Tonight Show.
What's that?
I think he did the Tonight Show with Johnny.
Yeah, maybe.
Bring
I don't
up,
know.
Yeah. Bring up the security guard from Empty Nest. What show was it?
Empty Nest. Scarecrow
Mrs. King. Scarecrow Mrs. King, yeah.
There you go.
Which was the original title of Empty Nest. But no, Weeds is, I mean, that show's, how many, 9?
It was 8 seasons.
Yeah, that's bananas for any show.
Yeah, yeah. I've had some good runs.
And that was your, and so you were about to say, like, that was when you were like, all right, SNL's my mark, right? Is that what you're going to say? Like, that's what I'm...
Well, that's that was a show that I think kind of made people take notice again that, you know, it wasn't just like another sitcom that went under the radar. You know, it was right up there with SNL where people were talking about it.
And Die Hard fans, and you guys would have cliffhangers where people were like, what the hell? Like,
yeah, yeah. Well, Showtime was turning a corner, too, with their content as being like on par with HBO and the big hitters of TV. And, and you were obviously known for the show title, but people think... You mentioned this in your act that people come up to you and want to smoke you out and stuff.
Yeah, they think I'm a big pothead. But, and now it's cool because when I go to do stand-up, I get a lot of young people in the audience.
I was just
going to
say,
Weeds fans. And then
the SNL.
Know me from SNL.
It's the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And so stand-up is now you've hit the road a lot more and obviously did another special.
Yeah. So I didn't do a special for a long time. You know, I never did a special because I thought, well, first of all, I don't think I have an hour of material because I keep getting rid of jokes that I'm tired of. And
it's intimidating.
Yeah,
when you look and say, "Wow, I got to actually build an hour," and you have to sort of hold on to jokes for a little while longer until you get to get them together in the special.
Right, and then you say to yourself, "Okay, so this is it. This is my best stuff. We want to put this down for an hour." Okay,
because you can always sit and you know gripe over things and be like, oh, I can make this better. But it's like even after you do it, you're going to look back and be like,
oh yeah, I look back at my first special now. I've done a couple. I did a half hour for Comedy Central that at the time I thought was really awesome.
Yeah,
and now I look back and I thought, oh jeez. And then I did a Showtime. You know, I mean a special for Showtime.
That's what I think about the first 10 minutes of this podcast. I'm just like, you know, oh, like you know.
I was.
I love how you just brush over some comments. It's so great.
No, I understand what you're saying. No, the podcast thing. Yeah. I'll never look back at this. I'll always remember this as being my highlight.
Yeah, the next thing after Weeds. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Is there one city? We'll wrap this up in a few. Is there one city you love going to more than others?
I like being home a lot.
I was going to say, you have a great stage in the backyard.
I do like Austin.
Yeah.
I like...
Seattle, where we did some
shows. I do like Seattle. Yeah. Even though I don't really go around much, I stay in the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, and take the Skyway over to the club.
Yeah, it's the best.
And you go to these cities, you know, 5-6 times. It's like, okay, I've seen the world's largest cashew three times.
Whoa.
It's like,
whoa, where's that?
Des Moines.
Oh. What I want to know is what is playing at the Cinemax. Cineplex.
Yeah.
But the thing, the really cool thing, though, about doing stand-up and working on the road over a period of time is, like, you can mention, you mentioned a city before or a club, and automatically I went there right in my head. Oh, it was St. Louis. You were talking about St. Louis Funny Bone. Yeah. Automatically, I knew exactly the configuration of the club.
Are you serious?
I knew what was around the hotel. I knew the hotel.
Yeah.
I knew the fountains outside the hotel.
Yeah.
You know your favorite spots to eat in that city. You immediately go there.
Mm-hmm. You know the little schwanky karaoke live band bar right next door to the club?
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. So you do get to see the country a lot.
Well, yeah. It's. I tell my friends, it's like, if you listen to that song, I've Been Everywhere by Johnny Cash, Road Comics can just go down and go, yep. Like, and we know all these cities. Like, we know the Des Moines, Iowa. We know the Dayton, Ohio's.
I'm going to two states this spring that I've never been to. The only two I haven't been to.
Oh, no kidding.
Can we guess?
Yeah, I guess.
Where in the world is Kevin Nealon going to?
I'm guessing Delaware.
Nope.
I'm going to guess. I was going to say Alaska, but I bet you've been there. And I'll take that head nod as you have been there. Kentucky.
Nope.
Oh, man.
Been there.
I'm out at this point.
Oklahoma?
There's a north of the south. States.
Dakotas?
Yeah.
You're going to the Dakotas.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I feel like that's going to be an amazing... Those are going to be great shows.
Those are theaters, so it'll be good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, geez. Yeah. And like, there's not even a club there, is there?
I don't know.
So, I mean, but you're going for the one night of a theater, and then will you have time to see Mount Rushmore?
I hope so. Yeah. I don't even know if I'm going to be close to it, but that's one of the... I've never seen.
We do a Mount Rushmore joke. Like, when you're in places like that, you try to write some local material like, hey, just saw the Rushmore. Why wasn't I up there? Hey, anyway. I mean, don't use that because that's not, you know.
I used to go see the...
or you can have that. I don't know.
I used to go see vaudeville, like vaudeville type shows. Like, they come through my town. They weren't vaudeville. I'm not that old. But it was... they'd have like Frank Gorshin doing impressions and stuff. And they'd have these little people juggling and...
My grandfather.
Yeah. No, the Harmonicats.
The Harmonicats.
And I remember...
Is that a Little People harmonica band?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Go.
I have missed my calling.
But they
I got to call up Peter Dinklage and get like a triangle band together.
Do you know him? Do you guys know each other?
Most of us do. I don't
know... not the English people.
Yeah. I don't know Dinklage yet. I've met just about every other little person, and we all get along except for Vern Troyer. Vern Troyer hates me.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of my act. He thinks I'm exploitive.
Oh.
Yeah, but he's doing very positive things, you know, getting drop kicked by Mike Myers in a movie, which is really advancing sure. the little people cause. Right. So, no, I could totally see his perspective.
By the way, I don't know Dinklage yet is a great title for your next album.
I think that's it.
All right, so you would.
Oh, but anytime somebody said something about the local things,
yeah.
it mm-hmm. killed. Yeah. Oh, he yeah. knows about our town.
Yep.
Even like when I saw Sinatra play at the Universal Amphitheater before he died, of course. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about Laurel Canyon, how windy it was. And everybody was going, yeah, that's Laurel Canyon.
That's our town. Wow. Yeah.
Just hearing the person say what they
can associate with the, yeah, that's where we live.
I saw the Rolling Stones a few months ago in Anaheim, where I live, and Mick Jagger comes out. He goes, "Hey, it's all right. We're in Anaheim, so if we get too drunk, we just take the monorail home." And then just people go, "Ah, he knows about the monorail." Yeah. And people just go ape shit, and like it's a terrible joke, but yeah. it's like Mick said something about our city. We're
yeah.
good.
Oh, yeah,
that's a great thing. If you're a big celebrity, you know, you're a movie star living in L.A. Mm-hmm. If you get too drunk to drive, you just get on that celebrities tours star oh, yeah. stars home.
They know where my house is.
You know where I live, buddy.
Oh man!
I think that's how Sandler gets home every night.
Kev, thanks for making time for this.
My yeah, pleasure.
It was absolutely. Great.
And you have a special on Netflix right now. I'm trying to
Whelm, but not overly. It's called
Whelm, but not over.
Yeah,
yeah. Whelm, but not
and,
overly.
That was my second 1 hour special. I think I'm out of hours.
Well, all the new material on Tuesday nights at the Laugh Factory.
They should have like a 5-minute special.
Would anybody ever do that?
I don't know why they call them specials anymore, because they're not that special.
Everybody's got them. It's all right.
Just another.
Did you like, though, that last special you did?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I like it until like 3 years from now. I look back and think, oh, boy.
now.
I remember I was going over to, I don't want to drop names, but I was going to Steve Martin's house one night.
Oh, I mean, oh, you could talk God. About this for the rest
on the
of the
way
podcast.
Over there.
Who was in
Who's
his
in
kitchen?
The kitchen? Yes. Lauren Mike.
What? Son of a bitch. All comes around.
But I remember hearing, they were playing his cat juggling thing on the 5-minute funnies or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Hey, Steve, on my way over here, they were playing your cat juggling bit." And he rolled his eyes.
Wow.
No kidding. Yeah. And that's like one of his iconic things. He's like, oh, yeah. That whole thing.
I guess, when people do Subliminal Man to you, or like, I'm sure Hans and Franz, people after shows, right? Or
yeah. I mean, it's got to be really timeless, like a painting where it still like holds up, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
but how do you, like, if someone does a Hans and Franz, you're just like, oh, yeah, that's something. I did that.
Yeah.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah.
Thanks for the update. Weekend update. You did update. Yeah, okay. Yeah. This is. Yeah. Yeah.
But thank you for allowing us into your home. Yeah. Thank you for coming home. On our podcast.
My pleasure. Check out the gift shop on your way out.
Oh, nice.
Well, if you think I'm not taking your Ellen mug, you're crazy.
Yeah.
And a Bonnie Hunt. There is a Bonnie Hunt mug, too. You're very sweet wife.
You save all the
out.
Talk show coffee cups.
Yeah. He's got a Chelsea, a Ferguson, an Ellen, a Bonnie Hunt.
And thank you for feeding us jelly beans and popcorn.
You're welcome.
Your Twitter. Where's your Twitter? At Kevin Nealon?
At Kevin _ Nealon.
Perfect. Was there already a regular Kevin Nealon taken?
I guess so.
You just got that underscore.
Set up for me, got me this one.
Well, he doesn't have over 1 million followers, so he's doing jack with it.
Yeah.
Every Tuesday at 8 at the Laugh Factory, new material night with Kevin
Once
Nealon.
A month now I'm doing it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, make it more special.
Yeah.
There you go. And then
March 11th is the next one.
Perfect.
And then if you're in North or South Dakota, he's coming there.
That's
yeah.
right, baby. I'll be there.
KevinNealon.com for your tour dates. Yeah.
KevinNealon.com.
Perfect.
And you do constantly tour, so to all our fans across the country, check out Kevin
like
Nealon's
it.
Tour dates. See him live.
Check
it's a great time.
Check it. All good.
Because, you know, hey, he could be in your kitchen.
Yeah.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. and I love you.